Hello and welcome to Season 13, Episode 22 of the Ubuntu Podcast. My oh my, it's hot in here. I'll tell you where else it's hot, in Alan and Martin's houses. Hello, Alan.
Yeah, hello, it's hot.
Hello, Martin.
Officially melting.
Hashtag Martin is melting.
Ubuntu melting.
Yes.
Alan, what have you been up to recently?
Probably unsurprisingly, I've been trying to make ice. My fridge freezer in the kitchen, it's one of those ones where the fridge is the top half and the freezer is the bottom half. It's an integral unit. And the freezer part has an integrated ice cube maker. Ooh. So there's one of the drawers where you just pull it out and magically ice appears and you take the ice out. And when you put the drawer back in, it'll make a noise every so often. Mm. And then a bunch of ice falls into the drawer and you pull the drawer open and there's more ice. It's magic.
That's very convenient.
That was a very good impression. That's exactly the sound my mum's freezer makes when you close that very specific drawer you've just described.
I've heard it many times. And it stopped working. And it stopped working a long time ago. And I couldn't figure out. At the time, I couldn't be bothered to figure it out. So we just got some ice cube trays, you know, the plastic things you fill with water and put in there manually. Annoyingly, they're just slightly too big to go in that drawer, which is really irritating. But we have some ice. But I thought, God, do you know what? I'm going to try and figure this out. So I went to the Oracle of All Information, which is Stack Exchange, and found a thread about how to take the ice machine out of this particular Miele fridge freezer, which staggered me that my internet search query resulted in a Stack Exchange thread where the answer had multiple photos with little arrows telling you where to press the plastic tags and how to pull the thing out.
Holy smoke.
Yeah, it was great. It's still busted, but I now have it out of the freezer. So it's one step closer to being fixed because it's no longer inside the freezer and I can actually poke at it. But it's weird because the ice cube tray has it's got a motor on it that just, it fills it with water, freezes the ice, and then turns it, rotates it through, not quite 180 degrees, just enough to like tip the ice out. But I think it's over twisted it at some point and it's cracked. And then you look online and everyone's talking about what jokers the people are who manufactured this thing. And, they all crack. They're all rubbish. And the replacement part is ridiculously expensive. So I don't know if this is going to be some combination of 3D printing or what, or frustration and eventually just buying a new fridge freezer. I'm not quite sure yet.
I'll tell you what, let's you and I have a conversation off air and I can introduce you to my friend Jackie, who is a sales rep at Miele.
Oh, I would very much like to meet Jackie.
I thought you might.
Martin, other than setting up insider meetings, what have you been up to recently?
I have been creating a Discord server.
Oh, this is like a modern equivalent of IRC, isn't it?
Where do I start with that? How do I begin to unpack that? I could say yes and no in equal measure.
Oh, that's a good answer.
It's where young folks such as yourself, Mark, meet on the internet.
Oh, is it? I should probably start doing that then, shouldn't I?
Right, yeah. But not just young folk. It's kind of, at the moment, Discord is the fastest growing messaging, video conferencing and voice conferencing platform in the world. It's outstripping everything. And obviously we can attribute that to the unique circumstances that we find ourselves in right now. But their whole pitch originally was around online gaming and enabling online gamers to communicate with in-game voice and text chat.
Right, yeah.
But they've grown far beyond that. And now it's a whole community building platform. And I have to say, it's rather fantastic. So I've spent some considerable time learning the ins and outs because it's a new thing to me and I didn't understand the subtleties of it, but I've been learning. And yeah, I've launched a Discord server to complement the YouTube videos that I've been doing recently in order to cultivate some community contribution to the projects that we're working on.
Well, speaking of communities, let's get on with the show.
Hey,
And this week on the show, we're going to be talking about building communities. Now, this is partly triggered by a video that was recently released by the Free Software Foundation trying to engage some people in their latest message around online learning and how a lot of universities and other teaching establishments have done a rapid shift to online learning and are using non-free proprietary tools from non-free proprietary companies to do that. So this is things like Zoom and Microsoft Teams and Adobe Connect and so on, and how these are bad. And they've decided to teach people that these are bad with a slightly bizarre video set in the University of Costumed Heroes and some story about how their online learning platform gets sold to Hydra, essentially, who then discover their weaknesses and take over or something. the reason that triggered this conversation is because it's not quite clear who this is meant to be appealing to, is it?
Right. And it feels like the FSF have this mandate to encourage people to use free software and discourage people from getting themselves locked into proprietary platforms. So I can understand the message that they want to convey.
Yes.
But the way they've done this, it feels, and the way they do all of their campaigns feels very patronizing and very lectury to people. And I felt like they could do a better job. And I wondered what we do in order to engage with people who don't know necessarily what free software is and don't necessarily understand the implication of the choices they make in terms of free and proprietary software. And so I wanted us to have a chat about how we engage with new people, how we get them on board, and not necessarily show them awful cartoons. I mean,
I think the internet has decided it was a pretty awful cartoon.
Well, I mean, someone somewhere produced that video and someone skilled created it. And so I'm not, you know, having a pop at the person who made it or the person who commissioned it. I think the motive was probably sound.
Well-intentioned, yeah.
Yes, but the delivery was a little bit weird. And I don't quite understand who, like Mark said, I don't quite understand who that's aimed at. Like what is really the goal there? Obviously, ultimately, the goal is don't use proprietary learning platforms where you're locking up your stuff inside a corporate entity's data center, and then, you know, they could be sold and you don't know what they could do with that data. But really, you want to engage with the people who are going to be using these products. So students who are being told to use Zoom and Teams and whatever, engage with them. How do you do that? How do you engage with these people? Where are these people? And how do you talk to them? And talk to them in a way that isn't utterly patronizing, like the way the FSF does, in my humble opinion.
Well, where they are at the moment is at home. Or they're somewhere online.
Right.
So I suppose there's a question of where does this target audience hang out online? And it might not be the same places that we currently hang out online.
I think that's a thing, is like the base level is the mistake that we've been making for years. We as a free software community is trying to like throw fishing lines out into a gravel pit of people and like wind them in and pull them into our little playground, which is not where they wanted to be. And we're trying to pull people over. Like for years, we've been trying to get people to use IRC or Mumble or whatever it is. Now, the goal is laudable. It's free software. It's open source software. And you're not going to get locked down to a proprietary platform. But the problem is that the vast majority of people are not going to join you in those places.
They're not.
They're just not.
No.
IRC is not friendly, and neither is Mumble. And so we need places where people can come and feel that they can engage with us and we can talk to them about the ideals that we have and the things we would like to engage with them on. But it's difficult to do that when, first of all, they've got to learn what an IRC server is.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like, you know, our community, and in particular, you know, there is an older demographic within the open source developer community. We need to meet the new generation of that developer community where they are hanging out, where they want to be, because like you say, they won't come and idle in an IRC channel. They certainly won't come there, ask a question, and then wait for 27 hours for an answer, which is like IRC protocol. They will ask a question, not get an answer in 7 minutes, and then leave. And then all of the neckbeards go, well, they asked a question, then immediately left.
Right, and they stamp their feet and get, you know, annoyed at this person who doesn't have the patience to sit there for 27 hours for an answer. And, well, why didn't you set up a bouncer? Or right. Why didn't you? Like, no, I just wanted to ask a question. And I feel like we're pandering too much to the greybeards, of which I think you and I, Martin, could probably have that, you know, name attributed. Neither of us sport a beard, to be fair.
No, I mean, I couldn't grow a beard if my life depended on it, but I'm pretty sure if I could, it would be grey.
Yeah, I've certainly stood in corners and tried really hard and it's not happened. So, yeah, I don't know how to do it either. But I feel like there's something that, yes, with age comes experience and, you know, and knowledge and wiseness, and the wise old owl is sometimes right. But also the wise old owl sometimes has the best intentions, but doesn't quite understand how the new people on the block are doing things, and they're doing things different and you need to change.
Yeah. And, you know, I spoke a little bit about Discord earlier.
Yeah. So you were saying that Discord is gaining popularity among today's youth, if you will.
I read about it in Smash Hits magazine.
I believe, Mark, you're referring to the GNU generation.
Oh, for God's sake. Anyway, so you're trying to build a community around your YouTube videos mainly, which are very much Linux focused, right? But you're building a community on Discord, which is a closed platform. But are people there interested in finding out about Linux? Are they interested in free software? Or are these other people who are interested in other things but happen to be on Discord that you can bring in and then teach them about the things that you're interested in?
So Discord is the follow-on, right? So I've been doing stuff in open source, you know, through the various open source code collaboration platforms that have existed for a long time, going all the way back to the sorry days of SourceForge and the, you know, the more contemporary days of GitHub, right? And I can create projects in those places and I will get some drive-by commits.
Yeah.
But I've been trying to reach a different group of people and engage with people in a different way. So I have been doing my development projects on YouTube via live streams and putting those projects out there on GitHub. And I have never seen as much engagement on any open source projects I've ever created ever. You know, I have dozens of contributors to those half dozen projects that I've created. Now, they're not particularly sophisticated, but the fact that I've done it on YouTube has brought in hundreds of people, thousands of people in some case, to view those. And that got me to thinking that, you know, you can engage with people in very different ways today. And video seems to be the platform to do that. So looking around, how do you then convert that, you know, video engagement into community engagement? So in air quotes, everyone's on YouTube. Where is everyone having a conversation right now? And it turns out right now, everyone is having a conversation on Discord.
So obviously the gut visceral reaction from the greybeards is, wait a minute, you're writing some free software and you're hosting it on a non-free platform GitHub and you're discussing it with people on a non-free platform Discord, and you're broadcasting it on a non-free platform YouTube. You're doing all of it wrong because you're doing it all in the non-free places. The tiny bit that you're doing, the kilobytes of of shell mm-hmm. script and stuff that you've created. Yeah, that's great and all. That's like added to the community commons, the corpus of software that we have created as a species, but you're doing it wrong because you're doing it using non-free tools. You should be on Library, Mumble, and IRC.
Yeah, and nobody would watch, listen, or contribute if I did those things, right? You know, that is not where the current generation of upcoming software developers reside. You know, I feel that we need to just suck it up a little bit and acknowledge that, you know, GitHub is where the majority of software development happens. You can't deny that you will get more engagement on GitHub than any other social coding platform. And maybe I could have used Twitch. Maybe I could have used YouTube. I chose YouTube. And it's undeniable. There is an audience of people there looking for this kind of content and also looking for a way to contribute via that medium.
Right. But that's numbers. What about morality and ethics? Like the ethics of free software. You're telling people I'm creating free software mm-hmm. and here is the source code and it's licensed under a good software license in inverted commas. But I'm forcing you, in order to interact with me, you're going to have to use this non-free platform because you have to use GitHub and you've got to go and sign up for a GitHub account. Like, people would argue you could have used GitLab. You could have used these other tools. And I right. get what you're saying, okay. that this is where the people are. But do you think it dilutes the message, the fact that you're using non-free tools to promote your free software?
I think you're probably right that because I'm doing this stuff via YouTube, I could have used any other code hosting platform and had similar engagement. But GitHub is the largest collaborative environment right now by some considerable margin, in the same way that YouTube is bigger than Twitch or Vimeo or insert, you know, name of any other video platform, including Library. Like, I have a Library account. I upload all of my videos there as well. So you just have to recognize where people are. You know, I never subscribed to the free software licensing because freedom.
Good.
Those licenses are very powerful, but the thing I took away from those licenses was the opportunity to collaborate. Mm-hmm. And that was their most powerful capability as far as I was concerned. So I'm more driven by the urge to collaborate and share, not by the virtues of the licenses and the morality of the licenses.
Right. And as Mark asked earlier, it was asking, you know, where are you pulling these people in from? Are the people that are joining your Discord channel, are they engaging or are they just, you know, idle people that happen to already be on Discord, just like I would be on IRC and someone said, join this IRC channel. And I do /join the IRC channel. And then I'm just another nickname in the list and I'm not actually engaging. I'm not contributing. There's no motivation for me to discuss this project in any way. I'm just yet another series of ASCII characters in the list of nicknames and that's it.
Right. So you can distinguish those people that are there idling versus those people that are actively engaged. And I would say that there is a leaning towards a younger demographic that are engaging in Discord. And what's interesting is there are people of our generation there that are a little bit experienced and jaded, maybe wise sometimes. And you have young, enthusiastic people who've got time on their hands and they're getting advice and guidance and mentoring from people who've been there before, who maybe don't have that time on their hands. And that's what I'm really interested to see. Like, one of the channels I have is around Linux podcasting. And one of the members said, hey, you know, I'm thinking of creating a podcast of, you know, 10 to 15 year olds, you know, targeted at young developers. And I was astonished to see that the first respondents to that with encouragement were visibly people with avatars that had grey hair and actual grey beards, you know, who were offering their, you know, support and advice and encouragement to do those things. And it's bringing together groups of people that might not move in the same circles. And I love that, because that's the ethos of collaboration that those free software license, that's what I saw in those free software licenses all those years ago. And is why I've stuck with, you know, free software development for as long as I have, because it's all about collaboration and working with other people. And I want to bridge, you know, gaps and find ways to work with different people in interesting ways.
So given that you're seeing some success with, you know, even in the short term and with a small number of projects, you're seeing some success with using these tools. What would you say, going back to our introduction, the FSF, what would you say they should consider given your evidence of one person?
As a data set of one, I would say that perhaps it's time for us to reconsider our values of the licenses and put ahead of that the value of communication, collaboration, and bringing a new generation through into an ethos of thinking that we all share.
Sounds reasonable.
And now it's time for a little bit of command line love. And this week's command line love is NVTOP. What's NVTOP?
It's brilliant. NVTOP. So I think we set the internet on fire with BashTOP recently, and NVTOP follows hot on its tails.
Is this some kind of thing for people who are really envious about other people's top output with many, many CPUs? Is it NVTOP? Is that what it is?
It's NV with a very green tint. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. So this is HTOP-like monitoring for your NVIDIA GPU.
Ah. So this is where there's like some that I can't remember what the command is, but there's a command when you're running an NVIDIA chip which shows you like the current memory usage and so on.
Right.
And
that's NVIDIA SMI.
Yes. Yeah. NVIDIA SMI, and you've got to keep running it, or you've got to run it with watch so that you get a continuous like updated output. But this is actually more of a utility for doing that for you.
Yeah, so you run NVTOP and it gives you a constantly moving NCurses bar graph of activity and processes that are running on your GPU.
Wonderful.
And a breakdown of how much of your GPU each process is utilizing, and you can order it and sort it in all the same ways you can do with HTOP and those sorts of things. And it hooks into the CUDA infrastructure on NVIDIA GPU. So it's very accurate.
Nice.
And it helped me identify a rogue process that was bringing my system to a standing halt, which is why I absolutely love it, because I found a thing that was running away and burning up my GPU and I didn't know it.
It's interesting that Windows 10 has this basically built in. If you run the task manager and click on the GPU, it has these little boxes broken down for what part of the GPU is doing 3D rendering, what's doing encoding, decoding, and all that kind of stuff. And my son has a Windows computer that was downloading Call of Duty or something. And I noticed that when the Blizzard downloady thing was running, one of the GPU threads was being pegged at 50% to draw the percentage bar of downloading. It wasn't actually doing anything other than drawing the little pulsing graphic on the percentage bar. And it's stuff like that that we don't have like integrated into our tools, our holistic.
Overall.
Yeah, exactly. We have these individual tools, which are great. But I think it would be lovely to have that NVTOP as part of GNOME System Monitor, for example.
Mm. Right. I agree, because it was actually a process that was monitoring my CPU utilization that was eating all of my GPU, plotting a graph I wasn't displaying.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And how do you get NVTOP?
Apt install NVTOP.
Brilliant.
Perfect. And now it's time for all your wonderful feedback. Kenny McLeod emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
What's this newfangled driverless printing thingamajig? You plug your laptop into a network, it detects printers available and installs them on your system. Whatever happened to manually installing them yourself, which could either be a 2-minute job or a proper Linux person's 4 weeks and 50 forums epic? Of course, it's all good stuff, but some application printer dialogues don't seem to handle it well. Thunderbird, for example, shows each printer on your system twice, one which is always asleep and the other which actually works. LibreOffice, by contrast, behaves as you would expect and offers only one printer per printer. This is interesting because I've noticed on some of my computers that they automatically detect my HP laser printer on the network, and then I see three printers in my printing dialog. So yes, I should probably file a bug about this. I've not thought about this long enough and hard enough to realize it was a bug, but I think it probably is.
Yeah, so to answer the original question, you know, driverless printing, this is an industry effort to simplify the ability to people to buy printers and then print.
Which you'd have thought this would be solved by now, right?
Mind blown.
But, I mean, I remember back in the 1980s, buying a printer and then using a pair of pliers to flip dip switches around on the back of the Centronics interface in order to get the thing to work properly, whichever computer system you happened to be using at the time.
Dip switches, you say? Oh, you were lucky. Yeah.
Shut your face.
I feel both ways.
I would like to point out, it's actually not that much easier today than it was back then, because they're just virtual dip switches that you're, you know, wrestling with. And I think driverless printing is fantastic because, okay, maybe a printer shows up twice. I'm looking at my print dialog now. I have two of them. I'm fine with that. I can print to either of them and it works, which is better than not being able to print to any of them, which was the situation normal we had before.
Who exactly should we escalate this bug to, Martin?
Well, we'll speak to Till, who, you know, is on the Ubuntu desktop team and is also the world authority on printing on Linux.
He is king of printers.
He really is, yeah.
Excellent. Jonathan Gregory emailed us.
Regarding the topic of editing PDFs on Linux, on the last show, did you know you can open and edit PDFs in LibreOffice Draw? And when you're done, just export the edited document as a PDF. It's always worked for me.
This is news to me. I did not know this, no. I have another meeting this Thursday where I have to present my PDFs, and I suspect I will be asked to edit my PDFs. So I look forward, after hearing this, I look forward to trying LibreOffice as one of the many, many options for editing PDFs that have been suggested. Thank you all who have DM'd me and PM'd me in all the various places, telling me the various ways in which you can fill in forms. Thank you.
Sam Van Den Ende emailed us with their favourite gadget.
I commute by train. A few years ago, I invested in a decent pair of noise-cancelling headphones, which I still consider the best tech investment I've done in the last years. Since I got them, these train rides have gone from being practical means of transportation to a moment of relaxation and decompression. So the last time I was on a train with a pair of headphones, I plugged them into my laptop and I opened whatever music player and I played the music. And for some reason, it was really, really quiet. I had the ear pods right in my ears and I turned it all the way up as loud as it would go. And I couldn't hear a damn thing. And then I pulled one ear out and I realized it was coming out of the laptop speakers because I hadn't pushed the cable in hard enough. Everyone was looking at me.
Well done.
Yeah, it turns out, yes. Big Daddy Kane being played on a Southwest trains, not good idea.
You're right.
Christopher Patty emailed us with a keyboard.
Yes, this was his favourite gadget selection, and he says, my WASD Skeletor mechanical keyboard with Vim mappings on each key, smiley face. One of the aspects of joy it brings to me is that it intimidates the crud out of anyone who might think to sit down at my computer.
I had a look at a picture of this keyboard, and it's basically got a Vim cheat sheet
printed on the keys.
So it tells you exactly what each key does when you're using Vim.
Does it tell you how to quit?
Well, I imagine it does. In fact, I think on the space bar, it tells you how to quit.
Nice.
I have to say, I was DM'd late at night on internal company chat by a nameless coworker. Hello, Rhys. And
I shall only be using his first name.
Yes, I will only
Rhys for canonical. His first
name. I was surprised it was Rhys. I was going to go for a completely different name there, but okay.
And he said to me, I've joined the keyboards channel, the internal keyboards channel, and I'm super intimidated by all these people talking about keyboards. I want to buy a mechanical keyboard, and I thought you might be a good person to ask. So I pointed out I'm probably the worst person to ask because, one, the main keyboard I use I bought in 1993 and I still use it, so I'm not a good person to ask. And the other one, the other keyboard I have, is only aimed at people who are massive ThinkPad nerds. So, yeah, you're going to have to find someone else. Sorry, Rhys.
I think the fact that your principal keyboard is from 1993 utterly qualifies you to advise Rhys that he needs a keyboard from 1993. And all of those ThinkPad nerds are basically searching for somewhere that's a halfway house between the glorious typing of a classic ThinkPad and a Model M keyboard.
It is the best of both worlds. Right. It really is. Yes. Sorry, Rhys.
Martin Tallassy emailed us with a cooking gadget.
A small, portable, wood-fired pizza oven. It's called Uni. It was originally a Kickstarter that's evolved into a Scotland-based company with several different sized types of oven. I have the older model. It runs on pellets, reaches temperatures of 500 degrees C, and makes excellent pizza. Or, if you prefer a cast iron pan, great steaks and roasted vegetables. I've never heard of this thing.
He sent us a gallery of pictures and it's excellent. It's really like a really thin sort of pizza sized oven with a chimney on. And he's got a picture of him cooking a pizza in it with also boiling a coffee pot on top at the same time. And flames shooting out the top in a very impressive fashion.
Oh, wow. That looks amazing. It's like a stone slab inside a metal tent, should we say, with a fire inside the metal tent. It's fantastic.
I would just like to say, when social distancing has calmed down a little bit, I think there are three presenters of a well-known Ubuntu podcast that might want to stop by from some quality oven-roasted pizza from your excellent purchase. Look at the flames coming out the top of this thing. It's like a drag racer. It's amazing.
There are a lot of excellent photos of pizza that we are now looking at that you can't see. I'm sorry, dear listener.
We will include links in the show notes so you can all enjoy them as you're listening to this.
Dustin Nisbet-Jones emailed us.
Previously, I had asked you about the new AMD Ryzen mobile and Ubuntu hardware support. Well, now I have a laptop with said AMD hardware, and the first thing I did was install Ubuntu 2004 LTS. Using the very handy Ubuntu mainline kernel installer, I installed kernel 5.7 and was delighted to find almost everything worked perfectly. Almost. My question for you all is, when can one expect full driver support with new hardware from an Ubuntu LTS? Is this sort of thing that may come out of the ISO in the next LTS release?
Oh, is this a thing like, would the 2004.1 ISO be the right thing for this?
Not the 0.1.
It's not new enough kernel for that.
So in the 0.1, you get bug fixes in like the user space, but you don't get a new kernel.
Oh, of course, because there's no next release to pull the kernel from. Right.
But in 2010, we are working towards a new kernel. And as I understand it, that is kernel 5.8. And when the 2010 release comes out, we will then be folding all of that kernel enablement and graphics stack enablement back into what will become 2004.2. So, Dustin, for your use cases, stay on the mainline kernel for the moment with your almost perfectly working system. And then you want to opt into what's called the hardware enablement stack, which, had you not flipped things around, would happen automatically for you. But, you know, you will then get flipped to the 5.8 kernel and the new Mesa stack and the new graphics drivers and all of that stuff.
Martin Carrizo emailed us.
2 years ago, I upgraded my MB server running Ubuntu Server 1604 to 1804. After it was done, MB had been removed completely. Why would it do that? My MB server is running on the same hardware in the same install since, and I would like to upgrade from 1804 to 2004, but I'm afraid it will happen again. How can I make sure my MB install is not going to be removed this time? So, it depends how you installed that piece of software. Mm-hmm. And typically, the way it works is when you go from one release to the next, so in your case, from 1804 to 2004, you're upgrading a whole bunch of packages, and some of them will have dependencies, and some of them will have conflicts. And as a result of that mapping of this must have that and this can't have that, you end up with situations where packages have to be removed in order to fulfill the requirements of new packages that are landing on your system in the new release. Probably when you went through the upgrade, it listed all the packages that were going to be removed, and MB would have been in that list. Now, unfortunately, it's a big list, and probably you just went yes and let it remove them and moved on. And then you can reinstall the software afterwards, a package built for the newer release. Typically, it depends on at the lowest level, it's something like libc. And if you happen to be running 1804, then the software that's built for 1804 is built against libc that's in 1804. And if you're running 2004, then the software is built against libc that's in 2004. So in the event that you upgraded, it's entirely possible that if you kept the package in 1804, it wouldn't actually work. So it tries to protect you from having broken software installed. I know that's no consolation. It means more admin for you, but unfortunately, that's the way it works.
And if your software is available via Snaps, you wouldn't have any of this heartache.
Yeah, feel free to contact the MB developers and tell them to make a Snap.
And finally, D. Scheimer shared some positivity on our website.
Sometimes I just want to say something out loud. I love Snaps and appreciate the work that goes into them. I always default to them when available and only wish that more software that I use daily were available. I appreciate the changes that Ubuntu have brought to the Linux world, and especially the part that Canonical has played in those changes. In a large part, their willingness to push, try, change, and innovate is a big part of it, even if it means that sometimes you have to pull back from what you think is best, because you just can't generate critical mass.
The check is in the post. Thank you.
And that's all of your feedback for this week. And that's all for episode 22. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you can listen again next time, when we will hopefully not be melting in our chairs. If you'd like to get in touch with us in between times, you can email show@ubuntupodcast.org. And we'd like to give a big thank you to Joe Reston for producing the show. You can find Joe's editing and production services at joerest.com.